You cannot instill hustle in someone. I have tried. It does not work. So there is like a passion, an aggression. You can see it in people that they want something bad enough that they will do something else that is not even connected to it to just show you how badly they want it. Those are the people you want to help.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Role Models Podcast, a podcast where we host candid conversations with inspiring women about their personal journeys, career histories, and all the valuable lessons and learnings they've picked up along the way. My name is David Noel, and I'm the co-creator of Role Models, the series of events, and this very podcast that I started with my friend and co-founder, Isabel. This is a special episode. It's a special episode because it's the very first live podcast that we've ever recorded with Role Models, and we're excited to share this conversation with you today. It's a conversation with our guest, Amy Emmerich, who is the Chief Content Officer at Refinery29, a digital media company that aims to inspire, entertain, and empower young women through optimistic and diverse storytelling. Amy takes us on a journey of her background in television and as a documentary filmmaker, and all the things that she's learned from a broad range of different job and career opportunities that eventually led her to become the executive at Refinery29, responsible for the global content strategy and the production. In this conversation, you will learn from Amy what she refers to as positive hustling with kindness, or how to make the most out of every job, and why seizing opportunities that come up, even if they're not quite what you expected, is sometimes the right thing to do. I loved speaking with Amy and really admired her energy, and in particular, the passion that she has for people and their stories. And I'm sure you will hear that in her voice and the way she talks about her work. Special shout out to the patrons of this episode who support this podcast with $10 per episode. We have Megan Quinn, general partner at Spark, and of course, a previous guest on this episode. And then Anna Carolina, who is a leadership coach based out of Berlin, and you can find on truecircles.com. Thank you to Anna and Megan for supporting the podcast, and of course to all the other patrons who support this podcast. This is the Role Models Podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and enjoy this first live podcast episode that we recorded with our guest, Amy Emmerich. Amy, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
And it's not only a recording of the podcast, we're doing this actually in front of a live audience in Hamburg.
I know, it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Give yourselves a round of applause.
Great. This is the first time that we're recording a Role Models podcast in front of a live audience, and it's the first time we're doing this outside of Berlin. So thank you all for joining. Amy.
How did I get here?
How did you get here?
I don't know. After beer and wine and beer a and fun wine. Hamburg trip, this is a kicker.
A very German introduction to this trip, right? Beer and wine and now sitting here. Thank you for joining us. We're happy that you are taking some of your time here in Europe to spend with us. I want to jump straight in and have a question for you. So I used to work at SoundCloud, and my first job at SoundCloud was community manager, right? And then I went through a career and had different jobs there. And you're now the chief content officer at Refinery29. And when I thought about this, like, both of these jobs didn't exist 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when we started off our careers. So when you think back at the beginning of your career, what was your idea of a job and a career at the time, and how has that changed?
That's an easy one to start off with. I'm kidding. I think I come from a working class family, so I think the idea was just always I knew I was going to work. Like, that was always going to be what happened. But when I was a kid of the 70s in Queens, New York, I grew up with a television as one of the parents. My parents were great, but the TV is what raised you and like babysat you. I had a brother who was 10 years older. My sister was 8 years older. And back then the neighborhood took care of each other, but that left you to the tube. So I was a tube kid.
What's tube?
TV, the TV tube. Yeah. So I basically just grew up off of, like, my brother loved Star Trek, my sister liked Brady Bunch. It's weird to have both those things in your brain. And I always wanted to be a camera girl. Not because I ever saw it. I just thought, like, I want to make TV. This is awesome. I want to live in there. It seems nice in that little box. So that was as far as my job that I ever thought I would have, like, aspirations. I definitely didn't even, this title didn't exist at the time. Digital media didn't exist at the time. Isn't that why they always say don't make a plan?
Why behind the camera? So growing up, where I was, seeing these, actors or stars or celebrities, in front of the camera, why behind the camera?
I just remember having a Super 8 camera. And that was, like, a really big, awesome thing to have in the neighborhood. And we would all film each other with that. And my sister was a hobby photographer for a while. So understanding that, like, her eye was dictating what the story looked like. And I think I just gravitated towards that. There was something about always being an art kid, too, in high school, that you were kind of drawing and illustrating, and it was what you wanted it to be on the paper. So I think all those things kind of lend itself together. I don't know what happened. I used to be one of those crazy kids that spun around in circles and did tap dance classes and, like, ballet. I'm the youngest of three. Those us youngest always want the attention, so I don't know why. But I just wanted to be behind it. But again, I think it's back to that Super 8 camera.
Did you? So you mentioned that you grew up in Queens. What take us back there and give us an image of what that was like?
You know, I think it's interesting in Hamburg because you're the waterfront metropolis. Woo! In Queens, New York, believe it or not, I come from, like, a boating family. So my dad used to work on wooden boats, and we lived off of a marina when I was a kid. So we roughed it. It wasn't a fabulous boat. It was a wooden boat, dry ice. We would live on that thing for weeks at a time. That was my vacation. That was all we could afford. So we'd go on the boat for 2 weeks at a time out the Long Island Sound. And it wasn't like your, I think, what people see in the movies. You didn't go to the city back then. The city was across East River. And it just was, like, bright in the distance. But you didn't go there. It was a mess back then. This is, early 70s. It was a mess. You didn't go. But Queens was really, I don't know, it's kind of like the neighborhood. It was all about the neighborhood. Kids ran wild. We were dirty all the time. You hung out from, like, ages 5 to 15, and you all took care of one another. We lived on a bus route. So I love buses still. I think the, like, rumble of a bus and how it makes, like, the windows shake, like, that was my entire childhood. It's I guess there's bits and pieces of it that look a little like TV, but everybody lived in the neighborhood. I think every relative I had lived in probably, like, 6 square miles. So everybody was always around. It was just a different time. No tech.
So when you say that your idea of your first job was to be working with a camera, and that was your idea of a job and a career. How do you think about a job and a career today?
I met a great cab driver once in New York City. And by the way, they're, like, 10 times filthier than the ones here in Hamburg. I'm obsessed with how clean these cabs are. It's like nothing I've ever seen. And one time I had a cab driver in New York City who I was just really kind of down and out. And she said, "What's up? What's wrong?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just tired of my job. It's hard work." She said, "Yeah, you and me got the same job, J-O-B. And I was like, she's totally right. And I still talk about that. I think there's jobs that you take to make money, to maybe just support the other dream that you have. And that's okay. And you should do that. My parents had jobs to support us. And then there's this, like, job. Your career, the thing you want to do that you really believe in, and it's going to provide you support system for the length of time you're alive. And I think there's both of those things kind of live together, circular. And the ultimate idea of a career, like, you're really lucky if you get there, especially in a place where you're happy. And sometimes you have to take the J-O-Bs until you can, like, finally settle in and find the career.
Okay, so how do you then think about that? Because it sounds easy in theory, right? But I think I've been in situations where you start really thinking about how to think about your career. And you're in a job, and suddenly your self-talk is around, you know, a list of things that you should be doing rather than the things that you feel you must be doing. And how do you get people, what advice do you have for people who are not stuck in their job, but who are thinking about, okay, so rather than focusing on a list of things that are keeping me here or keeping me from you know, daring to make the jump, what do you tell them? Because it doesn't sound like you have a you don't have a traditional career path, and we'll go into this more deeply. But I was curious to see what advice could you share with people who are where this idea of the elusive, eternal, always the same kind of career, and it's all super, you know, straight line. Like, how do you think personally about that?
I think we all put too much pressure on ourselves and whatever job we have today that isn't the one that you're supposed to have and that you dreamed about. And instead kind of taking a look at it like, well, what am I gaining out of this? And you should be gaining something. Sometimes you take the job for the money, and there is no shame in that. And you might hate it, and every day you get home and you're miserable, but you might tell yourself, I'm going to do this for a year, and I'm going to collect the money. But then I'm going to leave, and I'm going to take the next job. And the next job, I'm going to make nothing, but I'm going to love it. And I think that there's no right way in doing that. But we put pressure on ourselves and for so long are told you have to climb the ladder. I don't know what it's like here, but in the States, it was just so aggressive. You climb the ladder. And then somewhere along the way, I saw the lattice. And I was like, oh, I get it now. Like, I don't have to always go up. I can go sideways. I can take a chance. I can try something new. And once you get, I think freelancing helped with that. I had a staff job when I started out, but once I started freelancing, it was, I don't know, more fun. I made like more money in 6 months than I used to make in my staff job in a year. You still kind of spend those 6 months looking for a job all the time. You have the angst as a freelancer of like, I have to find a job. But there was something freeing about realizing you can survive that. And what do you do with free time? Like, as if you're not supposed to have that in your life. So, am I answering this question?
Yeah.
Okay.
How do you think about that free time? Because it's almost like the idea of the workplace and careers have conditioned us to think about filling every quiet moment or every moment that we're not working with giving us the idea that we have to work. And I know in Europe it's a bit different than in the US. I think the workplace cultures are slightly different there. But I think with the emergence of technology, with the abundance of content, with the abundance of pressure that we put on ourselves as well, how have you found a way to navigate that?
I mean, I did work a lot, so I should caveat that with my free time was spent working. I think I used to shoot camera. I did get there. When I used to travel the States and be able to shoot the camera, I would work nonstop for like 25 days straight so I could take 5 days off in a row so I could experience wherever I was. So I was lucky to kind of shape shift. I didn't have the normal 9-to-5 office career. So I always kind of, I don't know, leaned into the hustle. I really credit, I think, my parents who, when you're born and raised in like a blue collar working family, you don't know any different, but then like really hard work and hustle. So, I never had an issue with it. I actually take more of an issue with people who don't do the hustle and then complain about it. And then those of us who are hustling are picking up the slack. I'm more irritated with those people. Cause I don't know if I ever even knew what I was doing or why I was hustling was the ultimate dream. I just felt like you should take pride in your work. So if that's because you make French fries at McDonald's, you should make great French fries and you should serve them with a smile and say, here you go. I made these with love. And versus no matter what I was doing and how do you put your whole being into something because you're kind of judged on that. And at least I always judged myself on it. So I think I just always apply that because I was just in it.
Did you have a favorite shitty job?
A favorite shitty job? I don't know if I had a shitty job. I did, and maybe that's the labor in me. I think for every time I think of like a really bad one, I think of what I did get out of it, which is ridiculous.
That would
not
have been
a Pollyanna.
My follow-up question, by the way. Yeah. What did you learn from it?
I'm not a Pollyanna by any means, but I did work in a rectory. Does everyone know what a rectory? Catholicism, like Catholic churches. They have these little rectories in the back. I used to like carry the beer up for the priests. They always drank beer, which I thought was odd. And do mass cards. Like someone would die and they would come to me in high school and I would like write out the mass card. It was very bizarre. But it was interesting because I wasn't always going to church and it was something I had never seen. So I thought that was fascinating. And I did once get the privilege to shoot in a hospital. So I was filming ER and like 24/7 emergency care. We were shooting this for New York Times Television at the time. And it was just really, it was amazing. I got to shoot a harvest. Do you know what a human harvest is? Someone's dying and they harvest your organs. I shot the harvest, and because it was a Catholic hospital, I wasn't allowed to really shoot the whole thing, which meant I got to observe it. I mean, which never happens. So I wasn't even focused on working. I just watched this person literally giving up their organs of what a lung looked like and watching the heart come out. I mean, it was unbelievable. And then I watched that heart get transplanted into a man and the two lungs get transplanted into two other beings. I got to ride a helicopter, which was very exciting at the same time. And I remember just filming the heart going in. But then what happens is for the week afterward, I had to go in and visit those people to see if they were alive. And that was like the most depressing thing in the whole wide world. Every day I would walk in and go, please just be alive. I don't want to see the family, which the family were really enamored by me because I had seen the inside of their loved one. That's, no one gets to do that. And so you become part of their family as you're in and out of these rooms every day. But it was so depressing. You're alone, you're in a hospital 24/7, and you were walking in and out. And I just remember being like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore, like shoot these things, because it was just too much to bear. But of course, now it's 20 years later or whatever it is. And when I tell this story, people are like, what are you kidding? You saw a heart transplant? So I understand it was an experience that not many people have, but it was just so hard.
Talk a bit more about this time, because you eventually went and used a camera and filmed and did documentary and worked in TV. Why TV and TV has been, or TV or the moving images has been a big part of your career early on in the last 20 years of producing content. Why TV, and what is something there that what drew you to making television?
I'm sure I only went to therapy 1 year of my life, and I'm sure the therapist would tell you that because I came from like a very tumultuous home, the TV was an escape. So it was always the thing that like drew you out of it. So I'm sure that's another reason why I was drawn to it. But it's interesting how life plays tricks on you. Like I remember it being hard, but of course when you look back on your childhood, you also remember all the good. And so I think the idea that I could create an image of what life should be like in the good sense was pretty powerful. I was a hustler, and I just got the first job I knew I really wanted was a woman named Rosie O'Donnell, because I used to watch her on TV all the time, and she was funny. She had a show on VH1 at the time, and she was a stand-up comic, and she was really funny. And I just remember thinking, like, I am going to get a job on that show. And I went bananas on the intern coordinator, snuck my way in, and then I got that job. And I still wasn't shooting camera, but I was around a major talk show at the height of all things. So there was something about, I don't know, watching the cameraman. And back then, it was all cameramen. It was a studio show. Being in a control room, watching the directors. Rosie went through a few directors and in very high energy live shows like that. It's really, really stressful. But she was amazing at her game. I mean, I was learning from some of the best in the business, but I didn't even know that because I was out of college and an intern at the time.
How did you get in?
How did I get in? I feel like I just got an interview somehow. Okay. I think back in the day, you just made a lot of phone calls and harassed the shit out of people. And I literally still have the letter of, like, you got accepted as an intern. When I went for the interview, I aced the interview, but then at the end of it, the woman said, okay, great, you have to be here 5 days a week. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I have to work and make money. Back then, you didn't get paid as an intern. You got, like, a lunch stipend. And I had to work and go to school. I was still in college. I was like, I got to take classes. And she was like, well, then you can't take this job. And I was very lucky. Susan Quinn was her name. She was one of the women I met. And she said, no, I'll take her. She can be my intern 2 days a week. I owe her everything. And then Susan really helped me understand that I thought I wanted to be a director. And once I realized the directors had to, the first ADs had to keep time, I was like, oh, I can't do this. I suck at math. Like, so this can't be my job. What am I going to do now? I'm supposed to be the director in the studio and control everything. I was like, that's not for me. And then I got to meet all of the amazing people backstage at that show and understand behind the scenes. Who's here? Where's the shoe designer? I was saying how there's all these jobs when you're younger that you don't know exist. No one told me I could be a prop master. Doug Bailey was the prop master. He was working for Rosie and SNL at the same time, making crafts all day and sets. You don't know you could be a shoe designer when you're a kid. Like, you don't know that until you hit your first job and you really see what behind the scenes and what's going on there. And I think Rosie really just kind of like taught me what could be, all of the people that it takes to put a show on like that. And we were having a great time. It felt almost like the real college.
So it sounds like she had quite a big impact on your career early on. Susan, right?
Susan and Rosie, I would say, the whole team.
What is something they did that stuck with you? What is something they said or did, aside from showing you which options you have in the TV industry? How did they behave to show you that? How did they lead you into the TV industry?
I think something that, you know, looking back, we were nominated for Emmys quite a bit, and they always included us. So even when I was an intern or a PA or an AP, we got invited to the Emmy show. I have a plaque, not an Emmy, but we all got plaques that said we won an Emmy. And now that I look back, I thought that was so like really welcoming that they didn't have to say anything, but by doing and by including us in that process, we were valued. And I always say, no matter what job you have, especially in production, the interns were always the smartest, and they were the only ones who knew how to use the copier. Literally. That place could not copy anything without us. And then between, like, and that just, production especially is kind of like a ship. And I think, like, you have a captain, but everybody is needed. Every single mate on that boat, right? And production's similar. You might be a PA or a showrunner, but you really have to value every human. They each have a job, and if someone doesn't execute well, the show sucks. So I think that the way that they showed that to me had more of an impact on me and how I manage now than I probably would have realized back then.
So you spent time in TV with Rosie O'Donnell, and then you also took us a little bit behind the scenes of the documentaries you've done with, you know, heart transplants, lung transplant, being in a helicopter. So working, having your start in the more traditional TV business, how did you follow the emergence of digital media around that time, and eventually went through the documentary to, you know, Vice Media, and then eventually to Refinery 29, where you're today. So how did you perceive the transition from traditional media to new types of media?
Well, there was an important lesson that when I was out in the field and shooting, we were sending tapes back, and we got on the phone with one of our trusted producers, and I was saying, okay, did you get the cut of when she arrested the guy, and this is how you have to put the tape together, here's the VO, and he was stuttering, and I was like, Tim, what's wrong? And he said, I don't think you're going to like it when you get back to the office. And what we had come to find was that even though we were truly putting our own reputation on the line out in the field with what we were shooting, when we were sending it back into the office, someone else was making the decisions on how the story would be told. And I think I remember that aha moment of, oh, I actually have no control as a creative. I thought I did. I was out here dictating what would happen, but it was the people in the office who had the power. And I got very upset. I cry. I tend to do that quite often, as creative people do, and I'm not ashamed of it. But I tend to cry, let it out. It allows my brain to like think clearly then, wake up and go, well, I'm not going to stand for that. And I like fight again. So that was the moment for me when I was like, if I can't beat them, I'll join them. And I begrudgingly became a development executive. I took myself out of the field. I got a job in an office, and I cried again. Why did I do this? Why am I in an office? And I kind of leaned into understanding what will it take so that I don't think I was in a search for power. I don't know if that's what it was I was looking for. I just didn't want to be screwed over again. And I felt like I didn't want to watch other creatives get screwed over. So if this was what it was going to take, that's what I would do. And then I went from MTV, and I watched MTV rise and fall. I watched 800 people get let go. I watched a lot of people get put on contracts and like go golfing 3 days a week, and I didn't want that. I wanted to work. I wanted to grow. I moved to Travel Channel, again, another development executive job. I commuted to Maryland. That's a three-hour train ride for those of you, and commuted back and forth. And again, I watched another company argue at the top over who will be the president, who's going to be the big boss. No one paid attention to what any of us were doing down below. And I just felt like this is such bullshit. You're all arguing up here over these big, powerful jobs when you're not really caring, all of us that are sweating over what to make and how to do this and how to put this out on the screen. So I knew I needed a change. I had a sister who worked at a lot of banks until one day she realized she just didn't like banking. She's now a stay-at-home mom and doing a great job. And I think I kind of hit that wall. I was like, something's not right. I'm always miserable, and I'm always trying to pretend I'm someone I'm not. I'm in these suits. You know, I just didn't even know who I was. So I went looking for something different. And when I was at MTV, I met the guys from Vice. And so they kind of said, do you want to come to the dark side? Literally, in an email. And at the time, no one knew what Vice was. All the television agents said to me, why would you leave TV? This is a mistake. No one even knows what Vice is.
This was before Vice became Vice, right?
Literally, my father's 72 years old, and like last week came home and was like, I'm watching this thing called Vice Land. Do you know what this is? I was like, are you alive, Dad? Remember when I worked there for a year? No one knew what Vice was at the time. Shane would tell you everyone knew. But the television world was just about to really understand and accept them for who they were. Preston had just come on board. I worked at MTV. We all knew who Tom Preston was. So we felt like, okay, this is a great jump. And then I went from TV to this new digital company. But it also got me from Maryland back to New York. I was recently married. I wanted to figure out how to do that, be married. Society told me to have kids. I was like, all right, how am I going to do that? So I was excited to get to Williamsburg and work for Vice. And I think the idea of just to do something different. And there was something about them that was just no bullshit. This is what it is. And it was a very interesting year. YouTube just did the channels. So they were paying people to make content. We were making a documentary with Snoop Dogg. HBO pilot was in-house. And I was basically structuring how to create a scalable video business inside what was mayhem. So it was a very interesting moment for me. And little did I know at the time, though, that it was going to be like a thing that helped shape the rest of my career. Lots of tears. My husband being like, you got to just get out of there. What are you doing? I found out I had to go through IVF. That was not a place that a female was going to go through IVF. And it was just like I had to make a personal choice. I got out of that place. I did IVF. I had a baby 9 months later. So I had a very lucky, happy ending on that. And while I did that, I still stayed in digital. Scripps Networks ran Travel Channel. That's who I worked for in Maryland. They then kind of said to me, we didn't want you to leave. What happened? We thought you still worked here. No joke. That's what happens at big corporations. I'm like, no, I don't work here anymore, guys. They were like, all right, we'll come back and do this digital thing that we're going to build. And I got very lucky. I think you were asking how earlier. One of the tips I could say was I really tried to be nice to people. I don't think I ever really pissed anyone off enough that they would be like, don't ever hire her again. So I think they were like, all right, come on back here. And like in the moments when I thought I was barely working, I had a newborn, this little kid, and I was like, I'm not working enough. Most of the TV agents would be like, you not working is like what most people are look like on high volume. I just never could get back to the TV.
So now you're at Refinery 29, and I heard you say before in conversations you've had in the past that they brought you in to bring, you know, video into the mix of up until that point, mostly text-based media company. And so the switch from Vice to Refinery 29. So you said that before joining Vice Media, you were looking for something, right? How do you think about stuff when you look for something? What kind of questions do you ask yourself when you go into the journey of looking for something?
Is this going to be risky? What are they doing that's innovative? Am I going to be bored? Are they going to? What is it going to be like to work there? What's the pay like? Do I get benefits? Are there options? Is there 401k? Who am I working for? Who do I work with? I learned to ask for if you have a window in your office. All kinds of crazy shit that over time I learned you had to ask for. Is there a contract? What's the severance look like? Can you fire me? I want a non-compete clause. I mean, you just started to pick up things, and all of those things matter when you're looking at the full
package. How do you not
package.
Get paralyzed of all the choices then, or all these questions?
I think you need a good support system, truthfully.
How do you build that? How did you build yours?
I think I have a really good little mini army everywhere. I have stayed good friends with my high school crowd. So I've got 5 chicks who are all awesome. Some of them do nothing like this. They're going to listen to this and laugh at me.
This is the Queens cohort?
Queens posse. And they're like more like sisters. You all hate each other and love each other at the same time. I always say if you're a woman without girlfriends, you are not a woman to be trusted. It takes a lot of work to keep good girlfriends, especially over long periods of time. And that says something about a female's character. So that posse I have. And I think that there's also then good guy friends. I've got guys that I've been working with for over 12 years. And I think having that for me was needed. And then I've got like a wild family. German cousins that are butchers. We've been talking about them for the past 48 hours. I think that's good. And I think some mentors, I don't know if I would ever use that word, but I've worked for some great guys. George McTeague, Mike Powers, Fred Graver. These are all good dudes. And then I think I watched a lot of women early on in my career that didn't become mentors for me until this day and age, which has been really interesting for me. There wasn't that many women working back then. So the ones I got to watch, whether that was Rosie O'Donnell, Sheila Nevins, Jerry Laybourne. If you don't know these women, you should Google search them. They are all unbelievable in their own right. And back then I was constantly observing them. So whether I realized it or not, it was seeping in. And now in this position, I've been lucky to run into them again and really be able to have those breakfasts and those lunches and just be like, please help me. I did not plan for this. I don't know what to do with this. What is next? How do I handle this situation? And now those people that I knew 25 years ago are the ones that are helping me with like professionalism today. And I think that's another good takeaway. You really never know when you meet someone what is their purpose within your life. You're not meant to meet everyone and know them forever. That is not people's purpose. Some people come in and out. Some people are there kind of for a lifetime probably, but you may not be as connected to them as you once were. But I do think that for the most part, the ones you always remember meeting at some point serve a purpose. You just don't quite know what it is yet.
So for people who have the desire, who listen to this and say, I have the desire to seek a mentor. I know you don't like to use the word necessarily, or maybe we can keep the definition broad. You said that you have, you know, very healthy long-term relationships with your friends. But how do you seek out a mentor? Like when you're faced with a bunch of questions that you don't know where to ask, and you see all these people up there thinking, they've been there, they've done that, they can perhaps help me with this. How do you get there? How do you get that sort of advice from people who are a little bit more in the distance?
I don't know. I mean, they people have said you can't go ask someone, hey, can you be my mentor? It like doesn't work. And I also don't know if it's necessarily by age. I think that when I was younger, I needed my friend's support. No one wants to hear you like talking about your boyfriend 24/7, which is sometimes what you need to do. And I don't know if an older mentor would have helped me through that life stage. And then there's people at some point that now I'm 42, those older than me are the ones that I need help from. But again, fate luckily brought those to me. If you truly feel alone, I don't know. I think sometimes you just have to open your eyes to understand who is around you, and what might they afford to you. I also think people don't understand to just ask for the help. That becomes easier as you get older, believe it or not. At least I find you're so tired and exhausted that it's easier to find those work friends or work family that you can ask for help from. It's against like all feminist female values to say, I don't know if mentors work. I think women should be supporting each other. And if that means going for a coffee once, then that's what you should do. And then you should pay it forward and send them to the next person until like you can meet a match. But I don't know if there's like, I'm sure there's a book for this. I'm doing a shitty job telling you how to find a mentor that can do a better job.
I don't think there's a book on how to find a mentor.
Right? Oh, guess what?
Is there?
Okay, Google that. Good. I'm sure there's a book.
How to find a mentor. Google. Let us know if you find it. You're now at Refinery 29, and I think it's about 500 employees, right, by now. And it's been around for quite a long time, for over a decade now, started by four friends and around the table in Williamsburg, and has grown to the company that it is now. Focused on digital media for young women and producing, you know, different types of media. It's editorial, it's video, it's live events, it's shareable content. I would love for you to talk a little bit about, on the one side, the role that you have and how you think about your role coming in. So they brought you in to think about video and broaden out the programming offer and all of that. But I also want to take some time to talk about you, your role as a leader in an organization, right? So a C-level executive is probably a position that is typically associated with men, right, on the C-level, unfortunately. And I think it'd be nice to hear your perspective on that. Is for people who aspire to reach a C-level in an organization of 500, but maybe also of 5,000 or 300,000, How do you think about that?
I think the trick there is to get more women to aspire to get it. I didn't aspire to get this. I took a job at Refinery to become the SVP of video. I went there to build a video business. I knew it was a great opportunity, and I really wanted it. I took it pregnant with my second child, which was bananas at the time. I was renovating my apartment. I had to give birth, live with my parents in a tiny apartment with two children, and I still took that job. I knew it would be great. However, shame on me that I did not aspire to be the CCO. I did that job for a year, and the editor-in-chief and one of the co-founders, Christine, said to me, hey, did you know we were looking for a CCO? It was about a year in, and I said, no. She said, you should go for this job. And I said, what do you mean? I can't be the CCO. I don't know how to oversee editorial. I don't write. I came through video. She saw something in me I should have seen in myself. And she kind of knew, like, it doesn't matter if you know the expertise of editorial, you believe in creatives. And she kind of, like, said that to me so confidently that I was like, you're right. I should become the CCO. Who else could be the CCO? And she planted that in me. It just, like, you know, and kudos, like, because she was my internal, supporter, helped push me for that. And then the minute I got that job, that's when I realized, holy shit, this is a responsibility. I didn't know that. I was so caught up with, like, get the job. And I was like, all of a sudden I became a C-suite. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't have that many role models in the C-suite having tea with me all the time. I had no idea. And I think that's when I entered into this all of a sudden female power world that I had never seen all the time. And look, the timing is interesting. The past 2 years in the States, women supporting other women, there's more organizations to do that. Dining, dinner clubs, hangout clubs, the list was created. Like, there's all these ways for women at a certain role to start to find one another and help one another that didn't exist, at least not that I knew of, beforehand. And in doing so, I just got to understand, like, all, I don't know, I just had never seen that many women so confident living in this world of like, of course I'm a C-suite. And I was like, this is nuts. Is there a book someone didn't give me of like what to do when you're in the C-suite? What am I supposed to do with this? And all of a sudden, you're an inspiration. Three people said that to me this week. I was like, you need higher goals in life if I am your inspiration. I very much appreciate that. However, I'm still looking for inspiration. And I don't know if I'll ever get there and be able to walk around like with that male ego. Like, that's right. C-suite, baby. I am your inspiration. When my kids are older and I'm like retired and living on a beach. But that's inspiration to me. It's definitely felt like a very heavy responsibility. And I think no one talks about that. All of a sudden, you're not responsible for yourself. I'm now evangelizing for a brand. I'm talking about a mission. I'm responsible for other people and their careers. They didn't tell me that when I went for the CCO job.
One thing I want to follow up, which I found interesting, you said that Christine, one of the co-founders, saw something in you that you hadn't seen. What did she see?
I think I have no idea. I wish she was here.
What do you think?
I think she saw persistence. I think she saw fairness. Honestly, I really do put the company even before myself, which some people might say is bananas, but I really believe we don't just owe the audience, but we are responsible for the people that are working at that company. And if I owe them something, I am going to work until midnight until they get what they need. If they are working late, I am working late with them. And I think there's something within the millennial generation that feels a bit more camaraderie in that. I haven't had to pretend to be an executive at Refinery 29. The workforce has truly accepted me for me. Messy, still growing, a mom of two kids. That's all I post on Instagram. I'm probably not always detail-oriented, but they're not judging me for it. And I think Christine knew I would put my heart into it. And I think she knew I would always fight for, as a chief content officer, you're always responsible for all of the people making the content and what is fair. I really don't believe in the future businesses will be created to make money. I think, yes, part of a business is to make money, but without a purpose, a soul, a mission, what are you giving back to the world? I don't know how we as consumers will allow that to happen anymore. So I would like to think that more C-suite people will care. I probably have like too big of a heart, which is ridiculous.
How would your team, the people you work with, describe you as a leader?
I don't know. I think they would tell you, they call it Emmerich's magic box. They don't know what the hell. Oh, no. Emmerich's mystery box. I am a creative through and through, so you never know what you're going to get. I think they know that they would say that I care. They know that I'm loyal, first and foremost. I appreciate and honor those who are loyal. I believe that we are one team. So if you honor one another and treat one another with respect and understand that this is one team, that we will win. But anybody who doesn't do that is dead to me and dead to the team. You get a second chance sometimes. But I think definitely like trustworthy and loyalty are probably my two biggest.
Assuming one of those leadership or your role as a leader now, what is something that you thought was expected of you as a leader going into the role, assuming your role, and now you look back and like, whoa, I completely reframed that, or I completely changed my mind about it, or I have a completely different take on what it means to be a leader now?
I think tough love is interesting, because I do care about all those things. At the same time, I am extremely tough because unfortunately I do work and I work hard. So I tend to expect other people, especially at we still consider ourselves a startup. So I expect everybody to work hard at that startup, or at least manage my expectations of that.
What's an example if someone experiences tough love from you?
Oh, that's tough. God, he's hiding. An example of a tough love. I think breaking trust. I think the smallest thing of I send you an email and I, you know, who here hates email threads? Thank you. Oh my God, the death of me. So when I'm on a chain of 15 people and I send you a one-on-one to say, hey, I think you should do so-and-so, and then you take that email and forward it to 25 other people, come on now, raise your hand. Is that good email taste? No, you don't do that. That even that is like, to me, what are you thinking? I'm obviously trying to have a one-on-one with you. Don't betray my trust with this email chain. That sounds bananas. But I do think those small things start to add up of where you see value and how you see it. That can go as big as, I actually don't believe in people quitting dramatically. I think if you are not happy in the environment as your manager, I want to know that. And if I can fix it and make it better for you, I will. And if I can't, I will happily help you leave. Because I understand that people grow and people grow out of roles. We can grow out of someone if their growth isn't there. But when someone walks in and is like, I'm out 2 weeks, it's like, what do you mean you're out in 2 weeks? What just happened to the trust and loyalty we've built? That goes to show me all that I've invested means nothing. And then what I thought was a relationship didn't exist. So that type of person, I tend to think, I'm really not going to help you again. Because you're also not quitting on me. You're quitting on an army of people, and everyone has a role. So again, I think there's like a trust level there to have an open conversation.
So you work with a bunch of people who are probably earlier in their career, maybe first, second job. You mentioned millennials as a generation. And I think there's been so much written about it and also so many myths about it. And unfortunately, it has a bit of a negative connotation sometimes to frame things as millennial, which I don't want to do here. But how, like, in working with your work ethic, right, since the beginning of your career, looking back at it, 20, you know, more than two decades, what advice do you share with people who are earlier in their career to say, here's three things, here are three skills that you should be focusing on, that are not only super important for your job that you're doing today, but it's going to be a skill that you can port from one job to the next over the course of a career, regardless of which industry or which sector you're in?
I don't know if I'm reading too many kids' books with my children, but be kind is the first one. It's so simple, but be kind can truly stretch across anything that's happening. If someone else has to work late, be kind. Can I help you? Can I stay with you? Can I get you pizza? I think be kind also talks about your reputation. And before you know it, you've been working 25 years, 50 years. Everyone will talk about what your reputation was like every time someone goes to hire you. And I think the thing that people remember when they call for reference checks is that person was really kind. They were great to work with. You don't have to be the best at the job, but everyone will remember if you were kind in that role, and if you helped out, if you were a supportive team member. I think once you do that, people have more empathy and relax on what skill set you may have to grow on, because everyone needs to grow. But I think be kind is, like, to me, so simple, but people forget. So I think that's like just the biggest.
That's a great one. Two more.
Shit. This is like really hard. You people are very quiet. Two more. Okay, be kind. Always hustle. Positively hustling is what I call it.
How do you define hustle?
I think you have to find your passion. If you don't really want it, and I don't know what it is, but how do you, I think part of that positive hustling is finding pride in your work. And again, that's whatever work that might be. You cannot instill hustle in someone. I have tried. It does not work. So there is like a passion, an aggression. You can see it in people that they want something bad enough that they will do something else that is not even connected to it to just show you how badly they want it. Those are the people you want to help. I've said to people who wanted to work at Refinery 29, I don't have any job that you want. I have this job. Do you want this job? Do you want to get in the building? And I have seen people say yes and turn that place upside down, and before I know it, they're running an empire. And I think that's a drive that you really have to highlight to someone. Again, you have to risk a bit. I think you've got to lose your ego a little bit in that hustle. You got to believe in yourself more than you believe in the system. That's like long-winded. Does that count as three by any chance?
Was it three? Because you have one more. And then we're going to start. I lost complete track of time. So we're going to start thinking about questions. We're opening the floor for questions. But one more, maybe?
What's another
thing? Be kind, positive hustle.
You want to repeat the question?
The three skills that anyone should master early in a career that can be ported throughout any job, any career.
How do I say this? I hate manipulation. It's something that I hated about becoming an executive, is I felt like there was too much manipulation. Why can't people just be honest, say it like it is? Who's got time for this? But there is an art in understanding your audience and managing up in order to get where you want to be. And if you can manage that skill, the entire world is your oyster. And that, I think, is the hardest one to manage, especially for creatives.
What's the hardest choice you had to make in your career?
Believe it or not, leaving Vice at the time was a very complicated choice for me. It was the best one that I made, but I had to put my personal life ahead of my professional life, and I hated doing that. I had been climbing a ladder my whole life. I knew Vice would be successful. They were psychotics. Like, he was going to win. It was very obvious. So to choose to leave was really complicated. But like I had said earlier, there was no way I was doing IVF in that building. It wasn't going to happen. So I had to make this choice that I felt like society had placed on me. I'm getting old. That was like the only message in my brain. If I don't leave now, if I don't do this, it'll never happen. I hated making that decision. I was like so depressed. I felt like I was giving everything up. I felt like it wasn't fair as women. Why did I have to choose my personal over my professional? It just pissed me off. But like all things, of course, it wound up being the best thing I ever did.
What's something that helped during that time? Something you did that helped?
That I could have done? Or
through that feeling of hating leaving this job and being depressed about this decision, what's something that helped?
Exercise? No. I only say that because I hear exercise is really good for your thought process. And I think as women, we beat ourselves up a lot. And sometimes you wind up in this like spiral of despair, which is just so ridiculous. I always thought I would act tougher and get myself out of it and never share those things. But I think there is something to that that happens. And I wish I would have, I don't know, maybe if I was a runner, I could have kept running and gotten all that anger and like upset and emotion out of me. But I wasn't one. And so I don't know if there could have been it. I think I leaned on my friends a lot. I think luckily sharing a lot of the stories, hearing a lot of other friends' stories around IVF and how to handle this and how to manage my mental stability through all of that was really good. The takeaway there is like you have to get over whatever shame you might carry and be open enough to share something that might really almost paralyze you. Because once you share it and you realize there's other people going through that, you just feel so much better and it makes it all easier. So
we're going to open up the floor for questions. Anyone has a question for Amy? Think about it. No questions? All right. So I have one. I have one more. I have many more.
Ask me anything that's not business related.
What is a question that nobody asks you that you would love to answer?
That is a hard question. I think there's something so interesting about having to do this. I've been on like press tours all day with Henrika, and I'm like, I'm so sick of hearing myself. I've now been drunk, by the way, since I've been up here. Don't put that in the podcast. And so I'm just blah, and I apologize, but I've never been smart enough to like market myself. should I have sound bites? Would that be more interesting for you people? Do I need to think more of myself that I'm worthy? We're talking about me for this long? No, I am an average human being from Queens, New York. This is crazy town. If I can be here, anybody can be in this seat. And I think what's so bananas is like, do I have to change the way I think about myself in order to just own that and sit here and give you all the answers? I just don't know what the answer is. So no, like, I think my question would be something no one asks me. That question would change every day. I think, like...
What is it today?
What is it? I think it's, I don't know. What is it someone would ask me today? What's the secret to life? But now I have to answer it? You just asked me what the question was. No, that's not it. I think I think what I would love for people to do more, it doesn't have to be that they have to ask me every day. I know this is what you're going for. Look at this. He's shaking the head. Keep going. That's what I used to do as a documentarian. It gets you to keep doing this. I hate that everybody always asks, what do you do? I think from now on, and just test this out for yourself, you should ask people, where are you from? Because I think there's just so much more to glean from where people are from and where have they have been, not through work, because there's a lot that we gain out of our family and what we were born into and what we overcame in life, not out of the pure striving for it, just out of you were born in it. That I think is much more interesting about people.
I think that's a great answer.
Yes!
Sometimes it takes a while to get there. Question from the audience.
Yes.
Please say your name and briefly what you do so we have the context.
Oh, hi.
Where are you from?
Where are you from? Sorry, yeah.
Hi, I'm Laura. I'm from Bonn. And I'm a shoe designer. And my question is, you mentioned earlier that you have two kids, and obviously you're very passionate about your job and seem to be spending a lot of time at work. And how do you deal with the working mom's guilt, and what are the big challenges being a mom and being so hardworking?
I'm very, very lucky that my husband helps me get over the working mom's guilt, which sounds so cliche, but... whenever, like, how many people have watched Mad Men? Like, I just always try to flip those roles in my head. Like, I'm Ham, right? I'm John Ham, which is awesome. And so when I do feel guilty, though, and I come home and I'm like, this is horrible. I should be with these kids more. He luckily says to me, why would you say that? No one would ever say to me that I should be with the kids more. He's like, so you shouldn't say it to yourself. So he helps me with that. I also, someone once told me what you should do with your kids is remember, are you like so egotistical that you really think they only need your love to be turned into cool human beings? Like, no. They're getting way more out of life hanging out with my grandparents. Luckily, they're both here with us and they're spending time with them. They get a part-time nanny. They go to daycare. I live in an apartment building in New York City with awesome, kick-ass single moms who are the best people on the planet, and a whole community. So I just remind myself, like, they're having adventures all of the time without me that are going to be just as cool as the ones that I'm having that, thanks to FaceTime, they get to have too. I FaceTime them in no matter where I am, and they always ask me, where are you? What does it look like? Can I see the room? And I use it as, like, an educational tool. So that helps you kind of get over there's no guilt. They're better off. If I was home 24/7, Lord, help those kids. I am much better here with you guys than I am home 24/7. So no mom guilt.
Hi.
I'm
Sophie. I'm a journalist. I'm from Hamburg. And my question to you is, you've obviously spoken about your career and you've obviously had a very tumultuous career up until this point. What was like the most exciting time throughout your career?
Oh God, it was all exciting. Please don't think it was all tumultuous. I think it was too much beer and this guy stressing me out. I think this was the first time we've ever done a live podcast, right?
I thought you would.
Me too. It's weird. I had the most fun out in the field shooting, hands down. I think it was always an adventure. And again, I've talked about it. I didn't grow up with much. And then I got paid to travel. Like, that's awesome. I got to film weddings in Jamaica and in Italy. I got to, like, hook up with random strangers and, like, see it, the city through their eyes. I got to eat local food, and I got to do the hospitals. I shot in brothels. I've filmed police departments, like, so many women police officers that I now know, and I know what it means to be pulled over by a cop. Living in the field with a camera was, I think, some of the best days I'll ever know. So it's another reason I try to tell people, like, truly just hustle. I hate to use that word all the time, but my 20 to 30s working was fun for me. I mean, I tried to make sure I had as many experiences as possible. If you're not getting those through work, get them somewhere else, get your thrills on. I don't know how or what you want to do for you, but, definitely shooting camera was like just awesome.
Hi, I'm Natalie. I come from Uruguay. I live in Munich, and I work in technology. You mentioned a lot about the past and people who inspired you, but who do you get inspiration from today? Who is your mentor today, if you have one?
I was saying that a lot of the people I work with today inspire me. I do think I think luckily I'm pulling inspiration from everywhere. Honestly, my mom is awesome right now. She's watching my kids. I don't know how she stays so calm. I put that poor woman through hell, and I'm just so thankful she still talks to me. And so I pull from her. I pull from the women we work with all of the time because I just am really so amazed at how much younger women, how much confidence they have, and through social media and how much they put themselves out there. I'm inspired by a few of the women I worked with that I mentioned. I think I also just get I get inspired by competition, if I can say that. I feel like there's so much opportunity in the world, and I hate it when it passes us by. So I really get pushed to do more and work harder in order to kind of be the first through innovation. So I think that kind of inspires me more than even one individual. A lot of women here. I hear OMR tomorrow is just like a big sausage fest. So this is like a lot of ladies. Is everybody drinking, by the way? Please tell me you all have drinks in your hand. Okay, good. Just making sure.
Hi.
What's your name?
My name is Lydia. I'm an actress and freelance art director, and I'm from Hamburg too. And my question is, what are your personal life goals? Do you have one? Like, kind of, you know, not maybe not job or, you know.
That brings up a good lesson. Dream bigger, people. You know the cheesiness of those vision boards? Man, I wish I had a big-ass vision board when I was 13 instead of building them now. Literally a life goal now is like a beach house. I just want to live on a beach in one day somewhere in the future. I do think having a place where eventually my kids will want to go to, so I'm not trying to chase them down, is a thing. So I think everything I'm always doing, I'm like, this dollar is going to go towards the beach house. And then I'm like, I wish I had bigger goals. I would like to think that we do want to change the world. I've been working at Refinery for 3 years. I have a girl and a boy. I used to say I want her to kick some ass while wearing lipstick. And that was really far-fetched 3 years ago. And now I've got this little dude who wants to, like, paint his toenails because his sister sees that. And I just want to know that, like, his little blonde head, blue eyes is going to still have a place in this world. And what is that? And that's probably, like, the biggest life goal is that I don't completely fuck these kids up. And I figure out how to, like, help raise them and figure out how so much of what is shaping us as humans is literally happening at the age of 3 to 5, frighteningly enough. And if I can, like, figure out how to help change that, that would be, like, a really awesome, big life goal. And then there's just the beach. That's it.
Yeah. One more?
Really easy for you. Hi, I'm Katinka. I'm from Hamburg, and I'm an art director here at Scholz & Friends, actually. So our house high. I have one maybe a bit strange question, but do you have any like habits? Like these weird habits that kind of take you through the day, through your, you know, like just some little things maybe.
Little things. I feel like my inconsistency is my habit, believe it or not. If I have a too much of a schedule every day, I get like really bored really quick. I like the unexpected. I like taking the hard way or a different way every day. So I always say you have to get like comfortable with constant change. And I think without it, I would be bananas. So that's probably my weird quirk habit. How was that?
Good.
Pretty bad. That was no Kara Swisher.
I have the last two questions and then we have to wrap up. Typically, it's one last question, but there's one that came up. And so you talked a lot about the documentaries that you've produced and the breadth of different themes and topics and experiences and situations you've been in. If you would produce or make a documentary today, what would it be about?
I don't know if I have specifically one, but I think it's very interesting that Disney has only, out of every princess that exists, they've only done two movies about real princesses. And I almost look at that as an abuse of power. Because if I can make anything, I would make probably cartoons or you know, like animated movies that highlighted women from history. Because I just think they have been erased for so long. Every day I learn a new story, thankfully, because of the business that I'm in. And I would love to be able to find a way to turn every one of those female heroines into its own like amazing animated like huge film.
Right, sounds like your next career move there. Who knows? This is the last question that we ask every guest on the podcast, but also at our events. What is the, and it was interesting when you said vision board with the age of 13, because our last question, and this is, we ask it, we don't change it, we ask it every guest. What's the one single best piece of advice you would share with your 14-year-old self?
Not 14. I've been walking around Hamburg saying that I would tell my younger self to have more sex, but not 14. That was like for my 24-year-old self. My 14-year-old self... I think I would tell my 14-year-old self to not worry so much. It's that simple. Being a teenage girl is probably the hardest thing anyone will ever do. And so I think that would be, don't worry so much and dream big.
I think there's a excellent words to finish this off. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much. You've been very generous. The audience has been
You've
very
all
generous.
Been very kind to me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for making this first live recording of a podcast easy for us. Thank you so much for being part of this. Thank you, Amy. Where can people find you online? Where do you want to send people?
I'm like the Matrix. I just turn into twos and ones right after this is done.
Okay.
No. You can find me in New York City.
Online
at Emmerschmidt.
Emmerschmidt.
I think that's Twitter.
Twitter.
I think Amy Emmerich is Instagram. You're all welcome to follow me in the adventures.
Cool. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good job.
Thank you.
I hope I didn't ruin it for you.
If you like this episode, then why not check out one of the previous episodes of the Role Models podcast? We have had conversations with people like Cindy Gallup, who is a former advertising executive turned entrepreneur and a vocal advocate for more diversity in business. Or maybe Cindy Holland, who is the vice president of original content at Netflix, and where she talks about being a leader in a company that she's been with for almost 15 years. Or maybe chef and author Samin Nosrat, who just released a book about how to learn the fundamentals of cooking, and where she shares the story about how she just walked up to a restaurant carrying a letter and then left that restaurant with having a job. If you like to support Role Models because you like it, then please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. And then please also post a really quick review about what you think, what you like about the show, and maybe even while you're at it, click on the 5-star rating. This really helps the Role Models podcast reach people like you, and also helps the stories of our role models reach more people. If you have any feedback for us, reach out on Twitter. We're at Role Models. And if you have any feedback for me, you can reach me also on Twitter by tweeting @David. Thank you for listening. Until next time.